this candidate or president, does the president get to engage in an array of illegal activity because he calls it official? Is it in this so-called perimeter or outer perimeter that John Roberts and this faction have invented, created out of whole cloth to try to immunize this president? I'm hoping that the judges below, that in New York, in D.C., and in Georgia, they will find a way to ensure that that these criminal charges and the criminal convictions in New York in particular stand, despite this reckless and outlandish decision by the court. But we'll have to see. In the case of D.C., the trial judge, Judge Chutkan, is going to have to review every single part of that indictment against this ruling by this faction. But that judicial process, I think, occurs in one zone. And for the American people, I think we have to take seriously the fact that we have to protect our democracy from any president whom we could not trust to assiduously follow the law. Any person who seeks office who would try to use that office to punish their political enemies, I'm just going to say this in my personal capacity, is not fit for this office, given the new ground rules that this faction has attempted to set. And I look forward to the day in which this decision is repudiated and reversed for the reckless and lawless standard that it has set for the for presidents of the United States. And until then, we have to ensure that any person elected president does not have that criminal instinct that Donald Trump has already been convicted of having.
Yeah, and I'd like to ask Donald Sherman, the impact of the first Trump presidency and a possible second Trump presidency on the country's judicial system, given, as we've mentioned, that he named three Supreme Court justices, as well as 231 judges to the lower federal courts, almost all of them coming from a list created by Leonard Leo of the right-wing Federalist Society. What do you suspect would happen in a second Trump presidency?
Well, I think this disastrous decision is emblematic of it. Again, as we saw during the Trump term, many of his most dangerous ethical and legal abuses were thwarted by federal judges, including at the Supreme Court, where there was a sort of 5-4 group that included Chief Justice Roberts and the four liberals at the time. And, you know, I think in a second Trump term, one, there will be a 6-3 conservative majority that has already demonstrated that they don't care about ethics as it applies to themselves, and has just given the president of the United States carte blanche to commit crimes if they are somehow arguably within the president's official capacities. And so the checks and balances that existed and prevented the worst abuses in the first Trump presidency are no longer there. And in fact, the Supreme Court, engineered by Trump and Leo and the Koch network, has announced to the world that presidents are immune from criminal prosecution. So there's no universe where the expectations and the threat, the expectations aren't worse and the threat is not substantially greater if Trump assumes the presidency again, or if any president or if any person with criminal or dictatorial impulses assumes the presidency in the future.
Well, we want to thank you, Donald Sherman, Executive Director of CRU, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and Lisa Graves, Executive Director of True North Research, joining us from Superior, Michigan. Next up, 64 years ago this week, Patrice Lumumba gave a historic speech to mark the Congo's independence from Belgium. We'll speak with Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. Vijay also just visited the world-renowned intellectual Noam Chomsky in Brazil. Noam had a stroke last year. When Vijay was with him, Brazilian President Lula also stopped by. We'll talk about everything from Congo to Professor Chomsky. Stay with us. Cha-Cha by Le Grand Calle. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we've reported, the world-renowned linguist, activist, intellectual Noam Chomsky was discharged from a Sao Paulo hospital in Brazil in June as he continues to recover from a stroke a year ago that impacted his ability to speak. His wife, Valeria, told a Brazilian newspaper he still follows the news and raises his left arm in anger when he sees images of Israel's war on Gaza. Well, we're going to spend the rest of the hour with Vijay Prashad, the historian, journalist, and director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, author of 40 books, including his 2022 book, written with Noam Chomsky, The Withdrawal, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, and the Fragility of U.S. Power. Before we turn to this major piece, Vijay, that you just wrote on the Congo, we're going to ask you about your visit with Noam Chomsky. You're joining us from Cartagena, Colombia. You visited Noam twice in Brazil. Noam is now 95 years old. I know that his family is very private, as Noam was. If you can talk about, share what you will with us.
Well, first, Amy, it's great to be with you. And what can I say? Noam, our beloved friend, advisor, confidant in some ways, the one who helped explain what was happening in the world for decades, is 95 years old. And when he was 94, he suffered a stroke in June last year. It's difficult for anybody to recover from a stroke. If you're 70, if you're 80, it's hard to recover from a stroke. When you're 95, it's really hard to recover. But he's an incredible person. His body is really strong. When I went to see him in the hospital in Sao Paulo last year, he was undergoing physical therapy. I was there with him just about a week, maybe 10 days ago. Noam was in pretty interesting shape. He was opening his eyes. He breathes by himself. He's not on any kind of life support. He makes very deep eye contact. He plays with his dog, Gus, throws a ball with his left hand. His right side of his body is not able to move as much as the left. And while we were there, one of the days I was there, President Lula came to visit him. I mean, Amy, it's extraordinary. Imagine Joe Biden or any other U.S. high official coming to visit Noam Chomsky in a hospital. It's impossible to imagine. But Noam represents something to people around the world, billions of people. And when President Lula came, he said to Noam, he held his hand. They made deep eye contact. They had met before. And President Lula said to Noam, "You are one of the most influential people in my life." He said, "The other writer that has influenced me as much as you is perhaps Eric Hobsbawm." It was a very moving moment. He kissed him on the forehead and so on. Noam is 95. We wish him comfort. We wish him joy. We hold him in our hearts. He is perhaps the most important person from the United States to speak about U.S. power. And I mean, really, you know, what can I say? It's so moving to see him there with his eyes open, reflecting on what's happening around him. When I told him that our book on Cuba is in press and ready to come out, there was a hint of a smile. It meant a lot to me to be able to hold his hand and just sit there with him for some time. So, you know, he's there in the world. And I know that twice already, Amy, there have been rumors that Noam Chomsky is dead. I was able to tell him about the obituaries that had already come out. And again, he smiled a little bit.
And Vijay, could you summarize what you think is the most important legacy that Noam has left to the progressive and radical and revolutionary world?
I mean, it's an incredible contribution that he's made. Obviously, he's made a great contribution as a linguist. I can't speak to that. I'm not really able to understand much of those books. But I do know that, you know, during the Vietnam War, when Noam wrote his incredible text called The Responsibility of Intellectuals, he really put his finger at pointing directly at the U.S. Academy, at experts who were willing to go out there and collaborate with a block of power that was, you know, pummeling the Vietnamese people. Noam then, like a genuine intellectual with that immense responsibility that he writes about in the New York Review of Books, you know, he went to Vietnam. He went to the Plain of Jars in Cambodia. He directly saw what the U.S. bombing had done. He lectured in a bombed out building in Hanoi to university professors who had been cut off from developments around the world. You know, when he was asked by them, what's the latest Norman Mailer novel like? What's the this? What's the that? I mean, he had to talk about everything for them. What is important about Noam Chomsky isn't just this book about Israel or that book about Colombia or this position or that position. It's that immense ability of a person to stand up against the crimes of his own country, to take on the responsibility of the intellectual and not flinch. You know, I asked him once, Noam, you know, how is it possible that you're able to take all this criticism of you? You know, it's incredible amount of criticism that you face. And he said, well, you know, I don't pay attention to it. And then with a big smile, he said, I'm arrogant, which I thought was a hilarious statement for him to make, because if anybody knows Noam Chomsky, he's the most humble man. There's not even an ounce of arrogance. But what he meant was, I have a strength of character to stand up and tell them in Washington, D.C. that, listen, I've read all your documents. I know what you're saying. And this is actually the contradiction that I want to reveal about your crimes. And that responsibility of intellectuals articulated in 1967, the year I was born, that essay has gripped him his entire life. And I very much hope intellectuals today will take not just, again, this or that argument made by Noam, but the example of what an intellectual should be. An intellectual must be courageous, must be willing to study everything that the people in power say and write, and then talk back to them with confidence and clarity.
Well, Vijay, we want to thank you for your thoughts on Noam. Again, Vijay Prashad has just visited Noam Chomsky. He was just released from a hospital in Sao Paulo. He suffered a stroke about a year ago. Vijay is director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and author of 40 books, including two with Noam Chomsky. The 2022 book, The Withdrawal, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, and the Fragility of U.S. Power. Vijay and Noam's new book, based on conversations they had before Noam's stroke last year, is out this month. It's called On Cuba, Reflections on 70 Years of Revolution and Struggle. And as Vijay said when he was visiting Noam Chomsky, the Brazilian president, Lula, stopped by to visit Professor Chomsky as well. When we come back, we'll talk with Vijay Prashad about the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo. It was 64 years ago this week that Patrice Lumumba gave the historic speech marking Congo's independence from Belgium. Back in 20 seconds. Is a soft revolution song by Foy Vance. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. It was 64 years ago this past Sunday that Congo declared independence from brutal Belgian rule that began in 1885 when King Leopold of Belgium created a, quote, personal colony and forced millions of Congolese people to extract rubber, ivory, and diamonds. Belgium then took official control of the colony and continued the extreme resource extraction. In 1960, Congo gained independence and elected Patrice Lumumba, a progressive Pan-Africanist, as prime minister. This is an excerpt of Patrice Lumumba's historic speech, June 30th, 1960.
Nous avons connu que nos terres furent spoliées au nom de textes prétendument légaux.
We have seen our land seized in the name of ostensibly just laws, which gave recognition only to the right of might. We have not forgotten that the law was never the same for the white and black, that it was lenient for the ones and cruel and inhuman to the others. We've experienced the atrocious sufferings, being persecuted for political convictions and religious beliefs, and exiled from our native land. Our lot was worse than death itself. We have not forgotten that in the cities the mansions were for the whites and the tumble-down huts for the blacks, that the black was not admitted into the cinemas, restaurants, shops set aside for Europeans, that a black traveled in the holds under the feet of the whites in their luxury cabins. Who will ever forget the shootings which killed so many of our brothers? Or the cells into which we were mercilessly thrown, those who no longer wish to submit to the regime of injustice, oppression, and exploitation used by the colonials as a tool of their domination.
Congolese Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba speaking 64 years ago this past Sunday as he declared independence from Belgium. He was assassinated soon after in a plot involving the CIA. The U.S. installed and supported Mobutu Sese Seko, who ruled tyrannically for more than 30 years, plundering the nation. Yes, even as formal colonialism ended, violent resource extraction continues to ravage the Democratic Republic of Congo, now focused on mining, cobalt, lithium, and more. For more, we are joined by Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, where his new in-depth article is headlined, "The Congolese Fight for Their Own Wealth." It looks at how the Democratic Republic of Congo's vast mineral wealth contrasts with its extreme poverty caused by exploitation and conflict. Thanks so much for staying with us, Vijay. Just why don't you lay out your piece?
Well, Amy, today is actually Patrice Lumumba's birthday. He would have been 99 years old. It's important for people to recall that he was assassinated by Belgian intelligence, U.S. intelligence, and British intelligence in collusion with the Congolese military when he was only 35 years old. What he said in that landmark speech in 1960, when the Congo attained its independence, was that all tribal rivalries should be muted and the Congo needs to use its immense resource wealth, untapped reserves now valued at about $24 trillion. It's one of the richest countries in the world. Use that resource wealth for the good of the people of the Congo. Patrice Lumumba was an ally of Kwame Nkrumah, who in 1965, 5 years after the murder of Mr. Lumumba, published a book called Neocolonialism, where Kwame Nkrumah laid out the argument that Africa was not going to be allowed to develop because the West, which had colonized the continent after the Berlin Conference of 1884, I mean, not after it, but they divided up the continent in Berlin in 1884. Nkrumah argued that, look, we're not going to be allowed to develop our own resources because they think they have patrimony over it. Indeed, it's so interesting to look at this specifically. People may not know that the nuclear material, the uranium used in the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, come from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, from the mine of Shinanoble. And there, that mine's control was actually part of the debate and dispute. In 1960, the CIA worried that if Patrice Lumumba was allowed to remain in power, he might hand over the uranium to the Soviet Union. He had to be, therefore, couped. This question of who controls resources in a place as rich as the Democratic Republic of the Congo is central. Whether it was rubber during the time of the Belgians and King Leopold II in particular, or now coltan, cobalt, and other very, very lucrative minerals and metals. The issue of control over resources is fundamental, and governments are overthrown. Indeed, the state in the DRC, the state institutions, not permitted to grow to become mature state institutions at all. I was at the border town between Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mpondwe. In Mpondwe, you can see trucks just drive across the border, nobody paying octroi duty, customs duty, bribes being put here and there. And here's the nub of it, Amy. People say that, well, this is to do with corruption. Corruption isn't a particular problem. It isn't the explanation for the problem in the DRC. Corruption is the symptom of a deeper problem, which is the prevention of the Congolese to control their own wealth. Equally, people sometimes say, well, there are tribal wars and so on. This is a fundamentally inaccurate statement. There are 400 different ethnic communities in the Congo, 200 plus languages spoken there. There's a great deal of difference. The question is, the Congolese have never been able to put forward a national project around how to unite the people into a proper country and so on. This has always been suborned by external intervention. And that's really what we argue, that the Congolese need to control their own wealth.
And Vijay, you mentioned Nkrumah. In 1958, 2 years before Congo's independence, Kwame Nkrumah convened the All African People's Conference, and it really represented the generation of revolutionary leaders who attended: Amilcar Cabral from Guinea-Bissau, Frantz Fanon from Algeria, Nasser from Egypt, Sékou Touré from Guinea, and also Lumumba. Could you talk about that conference and its impact on the independence movements throughout Africa?
You know, it's very important that we reflect on Kwame Nkrumah for a minute, because just a few days ago, Kwame Nkrumah's eldest son, Dr. Francis Nkrumah, died in Accra, Ghana. Dr. Francis Nkrumah was 89 years old, an extraordinary pediatrician, highly respected scientist, and so on. Kwame Nkrumah is a much underrated figure in the African story. I mean, he is the person who, through the struggle in the Gold Coast, what was then the British colony of the Gold Coast, was able to establish the possibility of African freedom from colonial power. And at the same time, Mr. Nkrumah argued it wasn't just a question of national independence, but Pan-Africanism had to be central. The Pan-African consciousness had to produce African unity. The countries had to operate together. If they didn't stand together, they would hang independently. That was Dr. Nkrumah's very specific and important intervention into the debate about decolonization. And when he brought together these figures to the conference in Accra. It was a Pan-African conference. He counseled Patrice Lumumba when Mr. Lumumba was coming near power with the Mouvement National Congolais. It was Dr. Nkrumah who sent advisors in, sent people to assist and help the Congolese develop their political institutions and so on. Nkrumah did the same to others. Very interesting. In 1965, when he published his book, Neocolonialism, the Central Intelligence Agency of the U.S. government reviewed the book, considerable review, a real book review. And then they sent that review to all agencies of the U.S. government. You know, I often say that the coup against Mr. Nkrumah in 1966 is the only coup that was related to a negative book review, a book review done by the CIA. But really, what was threatening about Mr. Nkrumah was the fact that he had this African unity agenda, that it was under his leadership and direction that the Organization of African Unity was created in 1963. And the coup against Patrice Lumumba was, in a sense, a coup not only because of the resources in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but the political allyship that that Patrice Lumumba had with Nkrumah. They were together going to imagine the possibilities of African unity. English-speaking Ghana, French-speaking DRC, they would have had a captivating impact on the African continent. Coup number one against Lumumba, 1960. Coup number two against Nkrumah, 1966. And the continent then is, in a way, recolonized. That, in fact, I think, is a relationship. And that meeting in Accra, where he brings together revolutionaries from across the continent, is really a significant touchstone of the importance of African unity for people like Lumumba and people like Nkrumah.
And also, there's a lot of focus on the Congo's mineral wealth, but it's also has an immense agricultural wealth, enough arable land to feed the entire continent, and yet its people remain among the poorest in the world.
I mean, it's a scandal, you know, just the statistics, just the fact that the Congo has over 50% of the population in poverty. You know, one in six people in the Democratic Republic of Congo in extreme poverty, unable to find food to eat. It is an extraordinary country. People who have visited the Democratic Republic of Congo will say it is extraordinary in the sense of its immense wealth, its forests, its lands, and so on. It's like 60 times the size of Belgium, which colonized the DRC. It's an extraordinary country, but it has never been permitted, even now, to develop its own project. The Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia together produced a project to develop an electric car battery, but the government of Joe Biden intervened, subordinated the two of them to something called the Lupito Project, or the Lupito Corridor Project, that said that, no, you can't do this alone. Zambia and the DRC can't do this alone. The United States must be there as a trustee, as an overseer. And that ridiculous racist policy continues till now. The Lupito Corridor Project isn't a neutral project of development. It's a project to prevent countries like Zambia and the Democratic Republic of Congo from creating their own electric battery industry. You know, in a sense, there's an idea that these countries should only produce raw materials. They can't produce industry. And that has to be, I think, deeply contested. It's not just some right-wing people who have that view. This is the view of the Biden administration. This is the view of neoliberals around the world. They don't want to allow Africa to industrialize. And that's a very important legacy of Lumumba and Nkrumah, this demand and fight that we must be able to produce our own commodity chain. We can't just be, in a sense, the sluice for raw materials.
Vijay, we want to thank you so much for being with us again. Patrice Lumumba would have been 99 years old today. Vijay Prashad is director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, where his new in-depth article is headlined, "The Congolese Fight for Their Own Wealth." Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for Director of Development. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for BitCouver FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.